Tonight we're gathered under the title of Christian, Who Are We in a New Ecological Age? And my name is Jane Blewett. And now, having said that formal opening, I can kind of just say good evening and thank you for coming tonight. I hope we can, you know, Al and Scott are talking and just saying that surely when a group like this gathers, a big part of the event are the resources in the room, as the interchange and the thoughts and the kind of questions that arise among us. So we will be counting on that over these next few days together. I didn't say very much earlier on in terms of an introduction about myself, a little bit of my own story, but I wanted to do that tonight as a part of my opening, because in a lot of ways I think something of what has happened to me is really happening to all of us, and maybe it's just sort of a common ground that can help us come together a little bit. Scott introduced me as the director of the Earth Community Center, and people say to me, Jane, what's the Earth Community Center? And I say, it's me and a word processor and a file and some books in a small room in my home. And the birds outside, but also over these past 3 years, it is a growing community of people, really, with whom I've been in conversation across the country, and I can really say, I think, that even in this short time of 3 years, I notice a change in where people are, from when I was first invited to come into groups till now. I think people are at a new point in consciousness, just an awareness out there. But one thing that in my own story that was very striking to me, before starting my center, I worked for 13 years at a National Justice and Peace Center in Washington, D.C., called the Center of Concern. I come out of the Roman Catholic tradition. The center was started by a Jesuit, a Catholic priest, but in no way was it formally under any kind of formal organization. We did not get paid by the bishops or anything like that. We were an independent center. And we had a small group. There were about six of us on the research staff and another six or seven doing support work. And we did, you know, research and consciousness raising, workshops, retreats, public education on issues of justice and peace. And we had on our letterhead, the Center of Concern, : toward a world that is human. Toward a world that is human. And our effort was to build a more human, humane world where justice and peace were the cornerstone of society. And all our energy was invested in that. When I left the center, my husband and I were invited to come to a retreat center in Canada, on the northern shore of Lake Erie, where they have focused on ecology and spirituality for the last 10 years or more. And they had on their letterhead, Holy Cross Center, toward an earth that is community. And I think the transition we're in, really, as a people, as a species, you know, not just as a Christian community or as a church community or what, family, but as a species, moving from our total attention to a world that is human, to understanding that the context for that is an earth that is community. That we become part of the community of life of the earth. And within that, our human agenda gets attended. And so when I came back from Canada, I said, ooh, now what am I going to do? And anyhow, after some work and thinking about it, I started this center, and my little brochure is out there on the table for any of you, but just trying to reflect with people on, you know, building on the whole movement of greater within our churches, really, an awareness that we had to be people who were engaged in justice and peace, but not just for people. So I call my little thing justice for people, justice for the earth, two sides of the same coin. And for my part, over these, you know, days together, I'd like to really try to open that out for us as best we can, that our personal agenda has moved to being a social agenda, and today it is a cosmic agenda, if we are being faithful to our times, to our own times. The person that has been most informative for me, my mentor really, over the years, is a man by the name of Thomas Berry. And his book, The Dream of the Earth, is out there on the table. Tom is a passionist, a priest, 75 years old now, probably. He's been writing for 40 years or more on this question of the earth and its call to us to engage our spiritual journey, our total journey. He keeps saying we have to reinvent the human at the species level, reinvent who we are, as we kind of try to understand a new moment in the journey of the universe. And Tom and others are even saying today that, documenting in a way, that we as a species, or as this community of life that has journeyed over billions of years, that we have come to the end of a geological time, that the last 65 million years, which we've called the Cenozoic era, is coming to an end, and we are entering what they are calling today the Ecozoic era. Because the way we can say this, that for instance, the last 65 million years really began, the Earth marked that with the demise of the dinosaurs, that was a period of the Earth's life which ended, and the Earth itself took on a different expression. And the kind of evidence today, or the statement, might be something like this, that we as human cannot create a blade of grass. That's not possible for us. But whether a blade of grass will grow into the future has become increasingly a human decision. The impact of the human on the geological, the biological, the chemical, the hydrological life support systems of the planet is at a point as never before in the journey of the universe. And we use the language of devastation, the impact of our species alone. And how the earth will flower into the future is becoming more and more our decision. What we understand as species to be our place in all of this, and the purpose of the whole journey. So I, you know, it isn't just enough to say, oh, we're about this environment today, or, you know, it is the context of life for the future, who we are in relationship to the planet. And I guess I just want to keep saying that to us, that we will be we shape this reality in ways far beyond what has gone on historically in the past. Tom Berry has a trilogy, three sentences, that just haunt me. And I just want to say them to you. And, you know, he says, Tom says this, that the glory of the human has become the devastation of the earth. The devastation of the earth is becoming the destiny of the human. All human institutions, programs, professions, actions must now be judged primarily by the extent to which they inhibit, ignore, or foster a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. That's how we will be judged. Whether or not we, at this time, in this moment, in the journey, whether we as a species have learned that the great question that has to engage us now is, who is the human in relationship to the earth? We have asked historically over time the great questions of who is God and the human? Who is this divine other? And historically, at a certain moment, the great world religions emerged to try to answer that question. And in a way, we have institutions in place today to go and ask that question, who is God? We gather as a faith, as different faith traditions, to try to pursue that. We have a place to go for that. So that question engages us individually, but corporately we have answered that. The second great question that has engaged us over time is, who is this other human? We came to learn about, you know, today we know 5.5 billion people are on the earth. And I just think when my grandparents came to this country from Ireland, their whole world, this new world, was their great adventure into the unknown. And they, you know, and that risk, and they set forth, and with very little confidence, and all of you, probably many in this room, we could share our stories about that. But that was their world, Europe and the new world. And my parents gradually came to name a continent of Africa, or the continent of Asia, or the continent of Latin America. But that was a name for them. Today, I think probably everyone in this room, we have friends who live in Africa, or live in Asia, live in life. We have become, the social question has engaged us, and we have tried to answer that. Who are these other people? And we've come and we've struggled with how can 5.5 billion people learn to live together on the earth? And that question continues to engage us. It's not that the questions are over, indeed not, but we have addressed them. But today, that overarching question for us is, who is the human in relationship to the earth and the rest of the community of life? And it will be our burning focus as we try to answer and be responsible, be mature Christian. You know, what does it mean to be a Christian today? If we are not engaged in the great questions of our time. Earlier when, I'm sorry, is your name Kitty?
Kitty.
Kitty had spoken earlier this afternoon about her anxiety about the children and the grandchildren. That's how we will be judged. And if the question that if we do not engage ourselves in what will we leave the children, what will we pass on to the children, will we be looked back upon as a blessing on the earth or a curse? Will we be judged that we indeed are a blessing on the earth? And that was the great kind of breakthrough in human consciousness while we lived, that we became a blessing. They say if we held a parliament of all the species of the earth today, the human would be voted out. Out. So we come back to this, it cannot be just that this is a scientific question that engages us, but it taps the deepest religious roots that we carry with us. One of the things that's helpful to me as I try to go about this, I like this kind of challenge in the Gospel, in St. Matthew. One day when the Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and they tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. And this is what he said. When evening comes, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast, just like here at Holden Village. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of your own times. And I would suggest that for us as a faith people, as a tradition, as a church people, how can we help one another be engaged in reading the signs of our times? Our times. Not the times of our parents, or the future, but our time. And for us in the Roman Catholic tradition, that language of reading the signs was really the methodology that Vatican II put out to us as how we should proceed if we and kind of evaluate whether or not you are a mature Christian. If you are engaged in reading those signs and trying to respond to them out of the light of the gospel. So I say today, one of those signs, surely, as we try to just live, is the very cry of the earth itself. And Al is going to open that out for us with greater clarity tomorrow. The cry of the earth itself as a sign to us that the Spirit is speaking through that medium. I look around then and tried to gather over these last few years other things that would say to me, these are indications that there is something going on that I have to attend to if I am about the work of trying to be Christian today. And one of them came in out of a rather strange source in a way, but National Geographic magazine, that most of us probably know or have been reading over the years, celebrated its 100th anniversary, 88-89. And in that issue, they included a map, which was the latest in kind of update National Geographic, as only they could do it, an updated map of the world. 160 member nations now in the United Nations and all their capitals. And if you were a teacher, you know, you would hang this up on the wall and say, now children, this is what you have to learn. This is our world. You live here, and people live there, and this is what you have to learn. But today, when the National Geographic puts out that map, it cannot do that without including, basing that map on this reverse side. The map of the endangered Earth. And there is no way today that we can talk to our children or talk to ourselves as if this were real unless this is a viable planet, unless this endangered Earth is what supports the life that you and I claim as the human journey today. So I say the National Geographic is giving me a message. And in the listing on the endangered Earth, they list 12 different categories across the top of this. And you can come and look at this later if you haven't already seen it. Population pressure, air pollution, ozone concerns, species extinction, fisheries depletion, the spread of the deserts, the radiation, toxic waste, on and on. You know the names of them. And what our Earth is, how our Earth is indicating that these signs are beginning to impact the very operation, the very movement, the very ability of the Earth to sustain life. A second sign for me this past year was that I had the privilege of being a part of the World Council of Churches in Geneva, 350 member churches from around the world with headquarters in Geneva, had the culmination of a seven-year process that these churches have been engaged in since the last World Assembly in Vancouver. 7 years, churches around the world have been gathering, clusters of peoples, organization, parishes, church bodies, gathering to reflect together under the title Justice, Peace, and the new dimension that was introduced in Vancouver was the language of the integrity of creation. Justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. And in March of this past year, in Seoul, Korea, the World Council held a convocation bringing together about 500 representatives from that rural church to reflect on a document that had worked through those 7 years and different kinds of sessions and all. And the group was to gather and reflect on that. And to my mind, even though it was 7 years in the process, the language still, when we came together, was that people were not, it was not easy language to speak. Justice and peace, yes. Churches were very, and they had struggled with that formula and that agenda. But what did the integrity of creation, what did that add? Or what was that as the churches came together to struggle around that? And there was, it was about 10 days we were there together. The agenda was larger than the time frame allowed. And we really did not complete our agenda. So, but it was never meant to be completed in the sense that it is a process embedded in the whole World Council of Churches program and whatever, the future. The next World Assembly in Australia will carry on. There's a mainstream of justice, peace, and the integrity of creation all through the process. But for me, three things that I carried away coming home. One was that every morning we had a major liturgical celebration, a ritual. Language, song, music, reflection, prayer from all different parts of the world every morning. And on the stage, they had a big cross, But early on, the very opening evening, in fact, in a ritual, children of all different nationalities carried in an immense globe and balanced it on their hands and walked down the center aisle, and that was placed very reverently on the stage near the cross. And throughout those days, the symbolism of the cross and the earth together became more and more wedded in people's minds and hearts. You know, that we would identify anywhere in the world the symbolism of the cross. But to have that cross joined to the earth was a new emerging symbol that came out of that conference. One day, during a plenary session, a Native American Lutheran theologian, George Tinker, whom some of you may know, stood up and said, and this to me was probably a breakthrough moment in the whole conference, he stood up and said, if the Native peoples had designed this conference, had been about formulating this whole process, it would not read justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. It would read creation, justice, and peace. And it was almost like an aha moment in the group that we begin with creation. We begin with creation. And then from that flows whatever else out of life is going to emerge. And it was so symbolic that insight would come from a Native person. It would not come instinctively out of the out of our tradition, that we begin with creation. Creation, justice, and peace. A second event, and this is my third little moment during the conference that I carried away with me. I was at lunch one day with a Korean theologian, Protestant theologian, who was one of the host theologians for the event. And we were talking together, a little group of us around the table. And he was saying, we were all saying that, our churches have grappled with the issues of justice and peace for 20, 25 years. That thrust of how to create structures that really reflect justice and provide an ambience of life within which people can live. We've struggled with that as a church. But that the new dimension was this whole integrity of creation. And all of a sudden, this Korean theologian paused and he said, the more I think about this, the more I'm being thrown back on my Buddhist roots from which I had to be converted to become a Christian. And again, I think it is something of the insight that for us as a tradition, we have to be very open and stretch our tents very wide to be people today who are humble enough to learn from wherever truth is going to emerge to lead us into the future. And surely the native communities of this earth are one of the gifted peoples of our times. They carry a wisdom because of their own cosmology, their own religious tradition, to lead us into the future. And Buddhism also has a different sense of the relationship of the human to the earth. And I think we have to say, where is the wisdom today that can help all of us, while at the same time searching within our own roots? I'll leave this little report of the Geneva Conference out on that table for any of you who would like to look at that more carefully. But that, as a second sign to me, this kind of working together or struggling of peoples from around the earth to try to name how we as a tradition, as a Christian faith tradition, must be engaged with the earth. A third sign today to me came very recently across my desk. Some of you may remember that in 1972, the United Nations held its first world conference, the first time ever that the UN gathered the world community, and it was around the topic of the environment. It was held in Stockholm, in Sweden, the first UN conference on the environment. 20 years later, 1992, the United Nations is already planning for the 20th anniversary of that conference, and it will be held in Brazil. And the person who probably will play one of the very key roles now is the Minister of the Environment for Brazil, because that country will host this conference, and he will have a great deal to do in shaping that agenda. His name is Lutzenberger, and he was one of the delegates to the Seoul conference. He had to back out at the last moment because he had just been made Minister of the Environment by the new government in Brazil. But he spoke at a preparatory meeting of the United Nations, representatives from the UN gathering the committee that's preparing for this world conference. And I just want you to listen to one paragraph out of this letter, out of this speech. It's not long, but this is his paragraph. Fundamentally, he says, it is our world view. Our remote Judeo-Christian past has given us an anthropocentric worldview. We consider ourselves the only species that has rights. Our ethics is therefore truncated. It is limited. We see all non-human creatures and factors as outside our ethics. We may bring ourselves to the recognition, we may do this, to the recognition that the devastation of a certain wilderness is a mistake, but a mistake only to the extent that we are harming ourselves by wasting our future resources. We do not see it as sin. Most of the cultures that we now despise as backward do see it that way. Can you imagine, in the form of the United Nations, one of the world figures talking the language of sin? Cosmic sin within the context of the United Nations? We have moved like that. To my mind, that says that he would dare. The UN, in all its formulations over the years, does not talk religion. It talks the various cultures of the world, but it does not talk religion. It is too sensitive a topic. The UN cannot. It does not talk that. But here is a public figure who's going to play such a key role in this conference, and he's speaking to this world forum and talking the language of sin, that we have really come to a new level of our own kind of entering into the dialogue of the journey of the earth. The signs are around us on all sides. From within the Roman Catholic tradition, I have gathered a series of pastoral letters from bishops from different parts of the world, and who are just from Brazil, from the Dominican Republic, from the Philippines, from Italy, a couple within the United States, And the language they're using in the pastoral letter of the bishops of Brazil, they use the expression over and over again, sowers of death. S-O-W-E-R-S, sowers of death. And they say this, they say, sowers of death are all those who violently and irrationally attack the forests, and in so doing, poison the rivers, pollute the air, and kill entire populations. They do not say that sowers of death are those who kill the people. Sowers of death are those who destroy the ambience of life within which people live. So that the linkage between the human agenda and the earth agenda becomes stronger as we reflect on this together. That the future of the earth and the future of the human go hand in hand. Sowers of death are those who destroy the ambience of life for all. When I think about this, you know, and I read, you do too, I'm sure you read different reflections from the native peoples, from other traditions, I say to myself, why is it? Why? What out of our journey has made it so hard for us to feel at home with the earth? Why are we so alienated? And I come up with, and that's, you know, you, this is certainly for our debate and discussion together, but I lift out what I call four transcendencies that are part of our history. Not bad, certainly not bad, but in a way, as we move to the future, we reevaluate how we have structured our religious conversation, our religious journey, in light of that, and ask ourselves. So let me just kind of walk through them with you and test them. The first one, four transcendencies I call, the first one I call a transcendent God. A transcendent God. That as we have grown up, you and I, in our Christian tradition, we have posited that divine other, that ultimate mystery, that one that's beyond, we have posited that mystery up and outside the realm of the earth. That God lives in heaven. That we raise our arms, we lift our eyes, we build our churches with great steeples going up. That's where we have this transcendent God, is a God who has nurtured our religious imagination. And surely that is a facet of the divine as much as anything, of course. But we have also said from the very beginning that our God is an immanent God. That God is not only transcendent, God is also immanent. God dwells within. And not just within others, other people, but within. Within wherever there is life, within the process of life. Where else could life have come from if it were not for the ultimate other? But that expression, that way of knowing God has not been what has nurtured us. And today, I say that in some way, this focus on a transcendent that has taken us out of our earth is dysfunctional. If we try to say, we have to come home. We have to find a way to be of this earth, to be of this community of life, if the planet is to have a future. And so how else, what else might we call God that would help us nurture that? And I think today many of our theological pursuits will be to try to say for us to nurture an immanent God. And, you know, we have feared very often traditionally, we've said, well, you know, that's very close to pantheism. People will say that tree is God. No, we're not saying that tree is God, but certainly the life of that tree bears something of the life of the divine. Its life emerged from that source. And the imminence of the divine, that calls us forth to nurture our religious imagination. A second transcendency I would name is the transcendent human. As we read, as we celebrated tonight in our Vespers story, in our Vespers, we read from the text, our origin story tells us that on the last day, on the culminating day, this male and female were created. The image of God, the most, and whether it was intended or not, and that's where a great debate is going on today, whether it's a misreading of that text, but certainly the way we have internalized that is that indeed the human is made to the image of God. We are on the top of the heap, and the rest of that out there is made for you and me. Now, as I say that, you may say that's a caricature of this great sacred scripture. It may be, but it certainly is what we have internalized out of our Judeo-Christian Western humanist tradition, that everything out there is available for you and me. It is resource. We can go through that mountain, we can divert that river, we can plow, we can rip, we can take all the oil out of the earth and never think that perhaps that oil has a role in the geological shaping of the earth, of the planet. No, it's you and me that's important, our species. And if there is one thing that we're being called back to today, it is a new posture of humility within the community of life. That parliament of the other creatures who also have their right to this earth, need that water, need that air, need the forest, need the rivers, need the ocean, have their right to that, we find our place within that community. And you know, as we take on new filters, then we go back and reread. Today there's a whole lot of new exegesis, new biblical studies coming out saying, we have misread. It was never to be domination over. It was to be a stewardship of, or a caring for, or a nurturing. But that has not nurtured us. That has not been the basis for our interpretation of that Genesis story. St. Thomas, the great medieval theologian, 13th, 14th century theologian, says, and he has this wonderful phrase, you know, and now we go back and reread it and say, why didn't we understand that before? St. Thomas says, for God brought things into being in order that God's goodness might be communicated to creatures and be represented by them. And because God's goodness could not be adequately represented by one creature alone, God produced many and diverse creatures, that what was wanting to one in the representation of the divine goodness might be supplied by another. For goodness, which in God is simple and uniform, in creatures is manifold and divided, and hence the whole universe together participates in the divine goodness more perfectly and represents it better than any single creature whatever. It is the total community that gives us some inkling of who God is. No one species can do that. So we humans, this kind of transcendent human, comes to a new place in the journey of the universe. A third transcendency I would name is the transcendent mind. A transcendent mind. That, you know, you and I are products of the scientific revolution, the period of the Enlightenment. That 17th century revolution, really, in thinking that posited the way you know is through our rational, deductive, scientific left lobe brain. That's how humans learn. We deduce. Descartes' definition of knowledge was power over. The human learned in order to control nature. And that was our great achievement, and that's what the scientific endeavor has helped us, has forwarded that direction. What we have learned, you know, in more recent years is that, of course, we have a right lobe also that is the seat of intuition, imagination, dream, music, art, dance, and a way of knowing that is not available to our left lobe. The right lobe has its own mechanism for knowing and for the human to know. And it is through a different medium. They say today if you open the human brain, the left lobe would be this beautiful, convoluted, doctor here is in the room maybe, convoluted, juicy lobe. And the right lobe would look like a prune. Because we have not engaged those skills. And yet more and more, as we think about the future, it is, what can we intuit? What can we imagine it to be different? How can it be different? And it will be something of the gift of that right brain, that right lobe, not to say that our scientific mind, that way of knowing has not gifted us, of course it has, but it has been one-sided. And today, the kind of great opening that we challenge ourselves. For the native peoples, one of the first activities in many of the tribes, the first activity of the morning was to gather to share their dreams. Because they were convinced that in their dreams they were given intimations of how it should be into the future. Now we don't honor that. But there is something inside us that's saying, we know, you know, I think you can say to people today, people know in their gut that something is wrong. But we are, our imaginations of how it might be different are so stunted. And we need to encourage one another. We need to find ways to imagine an alternative future. So that this transcendent kind of overarching, controlling left lobe gives way to some of the other ways of knowing that can lead us into the future and the communities that have most developed those skills. And it's why I think that women will be leaders as we move into the future. Because historically, we have not played the same role in the public domain. We have not received the same kind of conditioning. And and the gift of intuition with women has been more freely and more historically opened up for us. And I, again and again, when I go around, I would say it is 8 to 1 women to men who come. And I say to myself, well, maybe, you know, they say, what does a woman have to teach me so they don't come? That I can understand that, maybe. But I say, women, is it because they don't have so much to do and they can come out of an evening and listen? No, I don't think anyone would agree to that. It just seems to me that women have an insight about the future. They are linked to the child and the future in a way that the male half of the population is not. And it is women who are awakening, and not women alone, but women in a predominant way. And I feel we have a great burden in our time because of that. My last transcendency that I would name is a transcendent technology. And again, I'm not trying to say that the gift of this microphone or our lights or the technology that has so enhanced our world is not a good thing. But as we look to the future, the grid that has to come over that is more and more what is advanced, appropriate technology that is in harmony with the technology of the earth. That the earth becomes the criterion. And if we cannot dispose of it, if it doesn't fit into the harmony of the way the earth itself operates, and we have learned more about that, then it is not appropriate for the future. I say about recycling today, you know, what's going on? Communities all over the country, all over the world. Did somebody, you know, some great wise figure go up in the room one night and say, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice to recycle? No. It is the very earth itself saying back to us, earth, cannot live and tolerate your profligate way of life. You must learn to be different. And we are learning. That once we take from the earth, we have to be responsible that it fits back into the earth. Because it is a cycle, and we are only part of the journey on the way. And to the degree that we can enhance that journey, that we become a blessing on the earth and not a curse. And so on my on the title for tonight, you know, who are we in a new ecological age? That's who I say we are. We are called to be a blessing, a species of blessing, who have the consciousness to be able to know that. That is our great gift, that we have a consciousness not available to other species. But each one has its own place, its own dignity, its own way of knowing. And each one of us called to be that, a blessing on the planet. And I think over our days together, you know, that might be a question that we can put to one another. Mm-hmm. How can we, in our own lives, in our communities, in our churches, in our neighborhoods, wherever we are placed, how can we be that kind of blessing into the future? There is a second little part to all of this that I'm not going to do tonight, at some point tomorrow, that would, in a way, when I say these four transcendencies and say that perhaps as we think towards the future, as we live towards the future, they seem increasingly dysfunctional. I think it's equally important to say, how can we go back into the tradition and lift out models that can give us some energy, some insight, some confidence that we can model something different into the future? And I'd like to just offer some, along with Al, tomorrow, some alternative modeling that I think is there in the tradition that we can lift out and perhaps look at afresh. But tonight, maybe it's just good to stay with our problematic and test that with in the community.
Are you open for questions?
Yes, surely, or comments, or you know, whatever, disagree, you know.
About applause.
That too. I was struck today by the fact that Americans voted down virtually every environmental issue that was on the ballot across the country.
Yeah, and we don't, in the United States, is the one country that's not signing on the global warming debate within the United Nations.
Why is that?
No, I take one stab at it. I'm sure there's lots. One piece of it is that we have a huge investment in the status quo. Our country, we have a huge investment, big money invested in, for the United States. Secretary Baker said yesterday in an interview, I heard it this morning on NBC, why we are sending more troops into the Middle East. It's blatant, you know, to protect our way of life. That any one country would endanger the industrial way of life cannot be tolerated. And at any cost, it will be challenged. It will be curtailed. At any cost, our way of life. And I think that whole mindset just continues to feed you know, that we are the important ones. And even you can say the human important and the American human the most important. The U.S. human, in a lot of ways. I mean, others have commented.
So many of these things are institutionalized. Yeah.
Aren't they? Systemic, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it's got to come from.
A change in system, in that,
system,
yeah.
And the individual minds and hearts.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But it is another thing to go from the individual to the system. I mean, there is social sin. You know, there's sin in the institution, in the system,
yeah,
in the structure. And that's been the kind of the struggle of the social community these last, 20, 25 years, when we've seen that more clearly. Social grace, yes indeed, but social sin. And how do you get at structures to transform them? Yeah. Yes, sure.
So you're discussing, you know, Americans and you know, our perception of, you know, how we should live, so forth and so on. It's been kind of my observation that Americans are very different from other types of people. We have a different set of assumptions. And the reason that we have a very low gasoline tax, for example, is that when it comes down to the collective decision of the democratic process, are we going to tax ourselves more money, you know, for this, that, or something else? The answer is probably going to come up no. And if the people have the power to limit the increase in taxation, Americans have proven that they would like to do that, for the most part, except for special things, now and again. We're reenacting, we're going to tax ourselves 50 cents per phone line in town to finance the 9/11 system, for example. Mm-hmm. But a general increase in the sales tax, in an income tax, or in a gasoline tax is not what Americans want to do. Whereas in other societies, in Europe, for example, or Britain, they have extremely high taxes mm-hmm. on fuel. And I don't know what it is about their societies that allows that to happen, but it's, mm-hmm. the mechanism doesn't exist in mm-hmm. America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think, again, there's, you know, many have other, that there is a stronger, there's a longer history of a social consciousness in many of the European countries, different from ours. We've come out of a different history, the political system, the political parties have been socialist for a long time in many of the European countries. So they have a history out of that. Canada, you know, right across our border, very different perception of what is the agenda of the body politic? You know, is it to provide for those who can least provide for themselves? And we say that, we say in our preamble to the Constitution, we, you know, to provide for the general welfare. But to really enact that out of our individual, you know, purses becomes a different thing. Yeah. The one thing, Al, you have a lot of things to say about.
Tomorrow's my turn.
Tomorrow morning. Okay. Al will talk much more about that tomorrow. But just, you know, among us, does it offend for us to look at our own kind of Christian community and just say, you know, we have a long way to go in all this. There's something in us that makes it hard for us to be people at home with the earth, that we really haven't. We go into our churches to pray, we go away from, you know, it isn't, we don't go out where, I mean, historically we haven't grounded ourselves that way, and that's a new learning for us now, that is a very deep learning for us. Does that, you know, is that contention on my part? Are you at home with that, or would you want to think about it? You'd say, gee, I don't know if I agree with that, or you're speaking something that is foreign to me as a Christian, or, you know.
Jane, I think your four transcendencies really are very penetrating, and for me anyway, mm-hmm. I haven't thought of that mm-hmm. in that context, and that's very revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, when I say institutionalized, sin or whatever, I think the four transcendencies show us where we got those, mm-hmm. a lot of the ideas that formed our mm-hmm. institution.
Mm-hmm.
We're the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we have to change that thing.
Yeah, I'm looking at you.
Well, I have a question, but I don't know how to phrase it yet.
Okay.
I guess I think that, well, I don't know how to phrase all this, but last night we had a discussion on women's reality. The term used basically was a male, what's the word?
White male system.
White male system, society, whatever, was the cause of problems in women's reality. Am I saying that correct?
Yep.
Okay. And I guess I have problems with white male, what is it?
System.
I'm sorry, I'm blanking. White male system as a very confining definition of what I think is a much deeper problem, and for all of us, to which you have certainly named, I think, is, to me, you've added to the discussion from last night, in the sense that I think that women, if indeed one accepts tradition and history that humans, man, is transcendent above nature, over nature, and one assumes that the female is connected with nature, there is a domination that kind of takes care of everything, mm-hmm. women and nature. Mm-hmm. If one has to have some control, transcend it, be sure that one continues mm-hmm. existence, you might say, mm-hmm. Nature is too oftentimes capricious. Mm-hmm. Nature is oftentimes not beautiful. It's also caught up with new birth, new life. And someone has some control over that. Mm-hmm. And I think our Judeo-Christian heritage has unfortunately erred in the realm of control here, mm-hmm. and who's in control. Mm-hmm. And there is a fear of women, I think, on the part of a male psyche, or a human psyche, that's pretty male dominated, a fear of nature, mm-hmm. and the capriciousness and malevolence that's also involved. Mm-hmm. It was also mentioned last night by Libby that talked about kind of the thrust of what we consider the heart of our Christianity, which is Jesus, mm-hmm. who comes and sort of turns things upside down, saying, no, this isn't the way it is. So I guess my question to you, Jane, or some way, is in terms of some very much of how we're shaped, but how do you see, if we can call ourselves Christians, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ playing a mm-hmm. different role mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. in our tradition?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or has that particular aspect been corrupt or co-opted too?
Yeah. And I tread very gently here. I'm not at all sure, but what I think is, today for me, is that whereas the historical Jesus has nurtured my life and been where the Christian community has focused its energy, I have a sense that we have called that the cosmic Christ will be the the more the face that we will try to grapple with and understand better as we move in our times. St. Paul has said, we've used that language, the cosmic Christ, there in the Gospels, but in the letters of St. Paul very early on. But it doesn't, it hasn't any meat on it. And I think that something of that St. John's, that the Word was there from the beginning, and that however we understand that, that we will begin, that will be an enlightenment for us, that we will understand that more. And not that we leave the historical Jesus, of course not. But I think we, at periods in our own journeying, I think God the Creator, that whole, we say, I believe in God, Creator of heaven and earth, and in five or six words we say all we have to say out of our belief system about 15 billion years. Well, that's not enough anymore. You know, there is a much bigger creator God that's being revealed to us today as we learn more about the creation. And I think there is more about Jesus that the cosmic Christ will reveal. And yet I say that kind of blindly even.
You said, I thought I heard you say that there was reference to that in the letters of Paul. But then when you quoted out of John.
Well, that's the only other place that I could name.
But could you name it in Paul? I'm not familiar.
Oh, well, in Romans, he says, you know, all of creation.
Philippians.
Yeah, there's several references. Now, and the several places St. Paul uses it, all creation is groaning.
Okay.
And all things are waiting for fulfillment. And, you know, that kind of expression, that's the kind of cosmic dimension. In the opening to...
Do you think there is a linkage between what you're saying there about the cosmic Christ coming to the fore in contrast to our emphasis in the Western world on the historical Jesus and a more rational approach,
mm-hmm.
more rational
mm-hmm.
theology in the West
mm-hmm.
as over against the East, Eastern Christianity?
More mystical.
More mystical,
mm-hmm.
more intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And there is where the theology of the cosmic Christ has, for centuries,
yeah.
been a very central
yeah.
And important feature.
Yeah, that's very good to remind us of that. Thank you. Yeah. Also, though, even in the Western tradition, there is a whole medieval, particularly, and it's one I would name a particularly... stream of mystics,
mm-hmm.
Meister Eckhart and Hildegard of Bingham and Mechtild and Julian of Norwich and you know, women and men who have been nurtured by this kind of a greening model.
Yes, especially some of the medieval mystics.
Yes.
But since the Enlightenment, there hasn't been that much.
No.
You quoted Thomas
no.
Aquinas, but he's pre-Enlightenment.
Yeah. So it would seem in a very real way that we have kind of limited or shut down the expansiveness that's there for us since the Enlightenment, even though you could say we are, the Enlightenment has also been an immense gift, you know, the unfolding and the way we've come to know, surely that's a tremendous gift, but at a cost. And today that, you know, we're looking at that a second time. I wish I could just find this.
Okay. Romans 8 and Colossians 1 and Philippians 2, those
okay.
Those
Colossians 1, it's the opening of in 1 that I'm that is so dramatic, and it's 5 or 6 times St. Paul. Colossians, you say to me?
Yeah, Colossians 1. Those are Christological hymns.
Okay.
From
okay.
the church, Colossians 1:15 to 20 or something like that.
No, that's not good. Anyhow, I am seeing people looking as if they've had enough for Friday night. Is that true for our opening night?
We can. I wanted to. One thing you said, Jane, that I found intriguing was when you're talking about these transcendencies. And about how, in fact, Christianity has emphasized so much the transcendent, and that's reflected in our architecture and in our worship,
mm-hmm.
as you know, as a young pastor, I was I suppose this happened after Vatican II, but even in the Lutheran Church, I grew up, you know, doing liturgy facing the wall with the people behind, and Jesus was portrayed largely usually up on the wall, or the cross is hanging. I mean, it's not never rooted in the earth, it's always
mm-hmm.
hanging up someplace, and
mm-hmm.
the emphasis was on the glory and
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But the others, it's interesting that also at the same time, and I guess this is related to your next point, and you're talking about the transcendency, or you're talking about the transcendency of the left side of the brain, theology became very rational and very materialistic,
mm-hmm.
and very technological, and nobody knows this better than Lutheran theologians. I mean, to be a good Lutheran theologian, you have to write at least 59 volumes, you know. And you need to have all your ducks in a row. And when a Lutheran preacher gets up in the pulpit, he or she is supposed to know exactly what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is gospel, and this is law, and this isn't gospel, mm-hmm. and this, you know, mm-hmm. and keep all the categories straight. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand you have this transcendent mystery, and on the other hand you have this what, control,
mm-hmm.
There's power in that, and so when theology begins to slide into anything that smells of putting the earth in it, then we, you know, then we become accused of being nature mystics and pantheists and all the rest. I don't know, with what? We lose control or something?
Yeah, it's a deep suspicion on the part of, like, I certainly, you know, the Vatican or people who are in positions of control, that this is something they cannot control. You know, it comes out of a different ethos, and it's just very dangerous because it's filled with life and juices and sex and women and darkness and, you know, and all that, and that's very dangerous. And
but those seem like opposites to me. I mean, aren't they?
Well, I see that little power being, you know, a little, like, it's like a little god. Here's the big god, and here's a little god. It's got it all lined up. To my mind,
I mean, all this mystery on the one hand, and yet all this rational thinking on the other.
Yeah, but the rational thinking controlled that, didn't it? Got it clear. You could tell the Trinity, you know, you knew all the definitions and all the, you had that god pretty well in place.
We said on the one hand the Trinity is a mystery, and yet we rationally defined it down to the right, to the, having the periods and the commas and all the T's across.
You know, the other thing that's a part of this too, I think, if there is some merit in that, you know, that presentation of those points, it's so imperative that we get music that reflects what we believe now. We sing always. God above, who reigns above, and we go singing, and it only reinforces it. You know, that's why it is like when I say to stimulate our religious imaginations in a different kind of belief, I think is the most urgent task. It isn't so much just to write new words, but how do we celebrate there? How do we nurture the fact that this is what we do, where we do find the sacred in our own time.